It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here in the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a historian tells us that the beach didn't always used to be thought of as a prime vacation spot.
First, Governor Walker appointed a new justice to the Wisconsin Supreme Court bench on Friday. Justice Daniel Kelly was picked by Walker to fill the seat that became vacant when Justice David Prosser decided to retire.
Here's a clip of the new justice speaking after Walker announced his appointment on Friday.
I trust that I will always stand humbly before the law.
Joining us now is Caitlin Farrell. She's a public affairs and investigative reporter at the Capital Times. She recently wrote a piece on Daniel Kelly's appointment to the bench. Caitlin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, tell us a little bit about Daniel Kelly's legal background. What do we know about his career?
Sure. So he has been a private practice attorney in Milwaukee with one firm. He was with one firm for a while, and then he went out and started his own. And he's argued several cases in front of the state Supreme Court before and in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. He's also president of the Milwaukee chapter of the Federalist Society. It's a conservative and libertarian legal organization. And he also was involved with the Kern Family Foundation, which is a conservative group in Milwaukee as well.
And what did his job application look like? People had to apply for this appointment that opened up after David Prosser announced his retirement.
Yeah. So in his application, I believe he submitted a resume, a writing sample. Governor Walker has a council of people that review those and then speak to his references and go through an interview process, much like any other kind of job.
But this is a job that most people are elected to, but because of the retirement midterm, this ends up being appointed.
Right. Yeah. So this ends up being an appointed position. And then at some point, if he chooses to run, he'll have to run for his 10-year term, just like we saw Rebecca Bradley do. She was appointed by Walker and then just won her election race here in April. So,
but that was a matter of months. This one would be a matter of years before he'd have to run to stay in the court.
Correct.
Now, what does this mean for the makeup of the court? What I've seen is not much, since it's a nonpartisan court, but people usually view some as conservative, some as liberal. This is, in effect, replacing a conservative with a conservative is how a lot of people are looking at this.
Yeah, pretty much. I think general consensus is that, if anything, Justice Kelly will be a more reliably conservative vote. At times, I think people thought Prosser, if there was any swing vote on the court, it would have been Prosser, but Kelly will likely consistently vote in the conservative majority. So as far as votes go, this doesn't really do much in changing anything.
But Kelly is an attorney, as you're talking about, from Waukesha. He has not been a judge before, which is, you know, not a prerequisite for being on the Supreme Court, but it seems to be common. Is it surprising that a non-judge got this appointment?
I suppose that depends who you ask. I think that prior to the appointment, a lot of folks thought that Mark Gundrum was a front runner. And so I think that this was surprising to some people. Justice Prosser himself had not been a judge before being elected, and neither had Shirley Abrahamson. Now, maybe especially in Justice Abrahamson's case, since she was a woman in the late 70s, that might be a caveat for some folks. But, Walker said at the conference that he particularly wanted, he picked Kelly in part because he wanted a mix of experiences and backgrounds on his court. He acknowledged that and actively sought Kelly for that reason. So
we're talking to Caitlin Farrell, public affairs and investigative reporter at the Capital Times, looking at the newest Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin, Justice Daniel Kelly, appointed by Governor Walker on Friday to fill a seat left vacant with retirement of David Prosser, announced just a little while ago this year. Caitlin, talk about some of the reaction we've seen, pro and con, to this appointment.
Sure. So one of the biggest voices that came out in support of Kelly was Rick Essenberg, and he runs a conservative legal organization in Milwaukee. And so one thing that I think folks maybe are excited about is because Kelly has written extensively and has a very intellectual approach to the law. You know, he has worked on some complicated and some say unresolved legal issues. And part of the Supreme Court's role is sort of creating a roadmap for other attorneys in the state about how they should interpret our state's laws. And so Kelly has experience litigating on those types of things, like redistricting, campaign finance, and conservatives think that that's good because he has a very, clear legal understanding of that. You know, in his application, he made some comments discussing similarities disparities and differences when it comes to affirmative action and slavery. And so we've seen a piece from the Isthmus, and Bill Leaders had written specifically about how troubling and extreme that was. And some reporters tried to ask Kelly a bit more about that during the press conference, but that's some of his writings and his application have been troubling to some.
Talk about that scene at the press conference.
Sure. That was what Kelly had written in his application, which was sort of breaking down and examining the legal approach to both slavery and affirmative action and how it considers race and granting people benefits or taking them away from people was something that reporters asked about immediately. Kelly was able to answer. He didn't speak to that point specifically. He just reiterated that he would have a bright line between his political beliefs and what he wrote in his application. But then reporters kept pressing him, and Walker wouldn't let him speak again. Walker sort of thought that the application spoke for itself. So he wasn't able to elaborate on that.
Yeah, and that was a passage from his past writing that was getting attention before it was known that he was the designated appointee.
Right. Right, yeah.
And the passage makes this, as you were saying, kind of an extended analogy comparing the philosophical grounding behind affirmative action and comparing it to slavery. And that's something I'm guessing Bill Leaders won't be the last person to complain about that.
Right, yeah. I mean, and he's pretty, I think it takes a couple readings of what his actual application said, but I mean, he says, quote, "Morally and as a matter of law, they are the same. I believe that there is a moral and constitutional equivalence between laws that subjugate a race, like slavery, and those that distribute benefits on the basis of race in order to foster some current notion of equality."
He did qualify that at one point, saying the slavery was more damaging. I think he started off with that caveat.
He did. He said there's obvious differences in practice, but he's speaking in a, you know, as far as a legal approach, and we're talking in that way. I think he's drawing a comparison there, which is troubling to some.
Now, again, the Supreme Court, the position of a Supreme Court justice in Wisconsin is a nonpartisan position, meaning when they run, they don't run as a Democrat or as a Republican. But everybody looks for signals about that. What kind of things do we see when it comes to any kind of partisan background for the new appointee?
Well, he has been hired by Governor Walker before, as I had written in my story. The Journal Sentinel had reported that he had been hired at one point to defend campaign finance with Walker's recall election, I believe. He also had done some work on the redistricting maps that Republicans had redrawn. And so he's litigated on, you know, in favor of conservatives on specific issues. And his involvement with the Kern Family Foundation, I mean, that's an explicitly conservative political organization. The Federalist Society is as well. And so, you know, we see in his past, he has obvious and explicit, you know, conservative roots in that way. And but he affirmed during the conference that he really views this role as very distinct and separate, and mm-hmm. said that he is committed to drawing a bright line between that.
Another issue in his writing that people have pointed to is same-sex marriage. Worried, he wrote that efforts to end the Defense of Marriage Act at the federal level would take the meaning out of marriage, I think you reported.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yep. He had included that as well in his application. So, and at one point during the press conference, a reporter asked him, you know, whether the public should be concerned that he had written on that in the past. What does that mean for if these similar cases might come up again? And that wasn't really directly answered, but he affirmed again that he's committed to a very strict, you know, text-based approach to understanding what the state constitution and the federal constitution says.
So saying his political and judicial philosophy as expressed in the past wouldn't affect his rulings as a Supreme Court. That sounds like what he's come back to and Governor Walker has come back to.
Right. And that in point, you know, plays to what his judicial philosophy is and what Walker has supported as far as judicial philosophies, which is, you know, a very strict text-based approach to looking at the law.
And he's been called a lawyer's lawyer by some other conservatives. You mentioned he had been endorsed by the head of the Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty. They see him as somebody very capable of this job.
They do. Yep. Yeah. Days before the appointment was announced, the director of that group wrote a column noting that, hey, this may seem unconventional. He's never been a judge before. But again, you know, he has worked through some really important, unresolved, and complicated legal issues. And when it comes to writing opinions that other lawyers will look to, That's what judicial conservatives want.
And then Governor Walker, as you'd mentioned, had appointed Justice Rebecca Bradley just before she then won election to a 10-year term. Any compare and contrast between these two appointments? Any connections between the two?
Well, they both, are from the Milwaukee area, and they both have roots in the Federalist Society. I believe Rebecca Bradley was as well. And actually, Dan Kelly, too, I believe, served as a kitchen cabinet advisor to her campaign in April. So they know each other. They've been involved, kind of coming from the same type of ideological pool there. So,
Caitlin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Caitlin Farrell. She's the Capital Times public affairs and investigative reporter. She talked to us about Justice Daniel Kelly, who Governor Walker appointed to the state Supreme Court on Friday.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we kick off a series of candidate interviews with the challenger in the Democratic primary in a Milwaukee area congressional race.
First, it's summer, and summer usually brings to mind barbecues, fireworks, ice cream, and, of course, lounging on the beach, taking in the surf and the sun.
But the beach wasn't always a place of fun and leisure. In fact, historically, the beach itself used to be seen as a place of fear and destruction. Think shipwrecks, desert islands, and pirates. All of which make historic and literary appearances again and again throughout time.
Joining us now to talk about the history of the beach and how it's thought of today is Daniela Bly. She's a historian and writer, and she recently wrote an article in the Smithsonian Magazine about the invention of the beach. Daniela, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Well, Daniela, these days we think of the beach as the place where you go to get some rest and relaxation. If you can afford it, you buy a house on the beach. But you say it really hasn't always been like that. In fact, it sounds like beaches used to be the place that you'd stay away from. Tell us about what people first thought about the beach.
Yeah. It's interesting. For most of human history, actually, the beach has been a very scary place that people have avoided. So if we look at, for example, antiquity, classical mythology, if we look at interpretations of the Bible, specifically the story of the flood, sort of what we see is that the ocean inspires sort of this deep sense of repulsion, right? We see people talking about the angry seas, the wrath of the ocean. And the coastline in particular is kind of this in-between place that is hard to define. It's a sort of where the elements meet, and it's especially threatening. The sea is a source of scary monsters, sea creatures, kraken, Spanish and Portuguese sailors and fishermen take relics and put them in the waves. So people are staying away from the sea and the beach. It's a very scary place. Shipwrecks, natural disasters, sort of all these associations are part of this image of the sea as a very frightening, threatening, chaotic place.
So when did that first begin to shift ever so slightly?
Yeah, it's kind of a process that happens in stages. And the process really starts sort of around the middle of the 18th century. And what happens is in Europe, and in Britain specifically, sort of we see new medical discourses among elites about sort of the sea, the salty, freezing sea waters as a place, as a restorative place, right? So a place where people who are suffering from medical conditions can take to the water. And, you know, it kind of becomes a cure, a treatment. There's a fad among elites. And sort of what that leads to is the rise of the resort. So we see in the 18th century in Britain the emergence of a few seaside resorts. And again, this is like a very elite process, right? So you have people going and dunking in the very freezing waters, and they think this is going to cure them. It becomes part of this whole new discourse on health and hygiene and fresh air and getting outside. And some of this is a response to the Industrial Revolution, which is starting. And then sort of the next phase is the early 19th century, where you have romantic writers and poets who are turning to nature. And they're looking at nature as sort of a place of self-discovery, a place of emotion and awe and terror. You know, so here we can think of, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, Lord Byron, Wordsworth, Coleridge, sort of all these people look to nature as a source of transformative experiences. And we see sort of the rise of, you know, you look at European painting or you look at travel literature, you look at poetry, sort of the sea and the shore becomes a place to go into nature and have these experiences. So it's interesting. It kind of starts as a medical process, and then we have this added layer of kind of a cultural turn. It becomes a cultural process. And then I would say sort of the third stage is over the course of the 19th century, and this is like a much more material process. This is the Industrial Revolution. This is sort of with the rise of the modern city. The beach gets constructed as an escape. Right.
So that's kind of what we have today, where you flee the city, and if you can afford it, you hang out at the beach.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, and then trains and sort of modern travel facilitate this process, right? So it gets imagined as a place that's away, it's apart, right? It's a blank slate. That's where you go to relax. You lie on the beach. So by, you know, by the 1850s, we've come, I mean, it's like a 180-degree turn from, you know, a few centuries before where the beach was this terrifying place that everyone's trying to avoid. You know, now it's kind of this civilization story, right, where everyone's taking to the beach and you have the spread of seaside resorts first in Britain and then across Europe and then in the rest of the world. So it's really kind of a dramatic transformation.
We're talking to Daniela Bly right now. She's a historian and writer in San Francisco, and she recently wrote an article in the Smithsonian about the invention of the beach. And Daniela, do you know if those ideas, those early ideas of the beach being a super scary place associated with monsters and danger and pirates, that kind of thing, was that unique to Western Europe more or less? Because if I think of some of the, you know, more tropical beaches around the world where the water is not cold, there are not rocky cliffs, it seems like you could have gotten a different culture around the beach.
Right. I mean, yeah, I think it's always good to avoid making generalizations, right? I mean, every culture has its own particular narratives of the beach, and obviously, you know, island-dwelling people are going to have a very different concept of the beach and the ocean than, let's say, someone in the middle of the United States or someone in the middle of Europe. But I would say this phenomenon of sort of the, you know, and I'm doing air quotes now, invention of the beach is very much a European phenomenon. And it really starts, I mean, it's really a British phenomenon, actually. I mean, the sort of, this is where the seaside resort first appears. And sort of a lot of the evidence we have about the ocean and the shores being very terrifying places, a lot of that evidence comes from European literature, comes from European art. So it is a European story in many ways. But, of course, sort of once Europeans in the 19th century go in search of, you know, new, quote-unquote, new unspoiled beaches, right, because their beaches are very crowded by this point, this becomes part of the story of empire, right, so the British Empire, you know, which reaches around the world, you have this sort of becomes part of the colonial project, right? Finding, quote unquote, new unspoiled beaches to civilize, basically.
And looking at some of the challenges that you say the beach as we know it is facing, you make the point in your piece that you talk to people who say that part of the problem with the beach is that it's sort of faceless. It doesn't really have a sense of place in a way, at least we see it that way, and that makes it vulnerable. Why is that?
Yeah. So because of this story, sort of these three stages that I laid out, and especially over the 19th century, sort of once you have masses of people escaping the modern industrial city, and the beach is kind of imagined as this blank slate, that has had really negative consequences. Coastlines are usually pretty sensitive habitats, and, you know, what we've seen in the last 100, 150 years is tremendous construction and human activity along the shore. So in California, where I live, I mean, the figures are astounding. Now 80% of the state's residents live within 30 miles of the shore. So we're gravitating towards the shore. And the numbers are going up each year. And because we kind of imagine the beach as this blank slate that's just for us to go and, pursue amusement, recreation, and so on, we haven't paid a lot of attention to the natural environment.
So are beaches as we know them and as we imagine them and want them to be, are they in danger today?
They are. So I talk about in my piece, I cite John Gillis. He's a historian at Rutgers University, and he's the author of The Human Shore, Sea Coasts and History, which is really a remarkable book that I recommend to anyone interested in this subject. And that's kind of his starting place, is sort of how we got into this terrible environmental crisis where beach erosion is happening all over the world. You have places on the eastern seaboard of the U.S., you know, trucking in sand every summer, just kind of this ongoing frenzy of construction and development, boardwalks, housing. This is the most expensive real estate, right? So it's become sort of the most desirable place to build and to live and to play, and it's really come at the expense of the beach.
Daniela, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Daniela Bly is a historian and writer. She recently wrote an article in Smithsonian Magazine about the invention of the beach, and she joined us to talk about the history of one of the world's favorite vacation spots.
Coming up after the news, we start a series of candidate interviews for next month's primaries. Gary George joins us. He's challenging incumbent Gwen Moore in the Milwaukee area 4th Congressional District. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, the Democratic National Convention kicked off in Philadelphia today. We'll get the latest from WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief, who's on the ground at the convention.
First, the presidential election isn't the only game in town. Congress is up for grabs this November, but there's voting to come even sooner in parts of Wisconsin. For congressional seats with more than one candidate in a party, there's a primary election next month on Tuesday, August 9th. We've invited candidates in those races to join us on Central Time and the Joy Cardine Show over the next 2 weeks.
We'll start in Wisconsin's 4th District in the Milwaukee area. Incumbent Democrat Gwen Moore is facing a primary challenge for the second time in a row from former state senator Gary George.
The winner of that primary would face two candidates in the November general election, independent Robert R. Raymond and libertarian Andy Craig. There are no Republicans on the ballot.
Gary George is with us now. He's a former Wisconsin state senator, and he's running for Congress in Wisconsin's 4th Democratic primary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And to start off, why are you challenging fellow Democrat Gwen Moore again in 2016?
Gwen's been in Congress 12 years, and if you look at what's happened over those 12 years, Milwaukee County, the district of the communities that are part of the 4th Congressional District, in particular the city, have just gone down and down and down in that time. And while Gwen isn't solely responsible, I think the blame is spread across those who represent this area, including the state government. And I think we need someone who can actually get something done. I have a history of being bipartisan and getting things accomplished for Milwaukee during my almost 23 years in the Wisconsin legislature. And I think I can deliver and not just talk. I think it's ironic that Gwen is the only person who talks this week at the Democratic National Convention, because that's really what we get. We get sort of a token presence and talking when I think the people in this community need somebody to get results.
Well, fill us in on more of the details of your background, and if you can, connect the dots as to why you think that makes you the better candidate, in your opinion, for Congress.
Well, Veronica, I think the place to start is what's going on in Milwaukee right now. We have a crime wave. and it's a contagion that's spreading, and it's consuming average people in this community, both within the city and the suburbs. It's spreading to our suburbs that are within this district, Brown Deer, Glendale, where Bayshore Mall is, down on the south side, National Avenue. We have carjackings, attacks on police. Every night on the news, we see some type of horrific criminal act involving shootings, stabbings, traffic accidents that are just horrendous. And we had a brainstorming session, our community group, Saturday at St. Matthew's Church. And again, Gwen had a chance to explain what she's doing, and it's just all talk. It's proposals and sitting on committees, none of which is delivering the resources we need to really address the main problems. And I think your listeners are thoughtful. You know, I'm a big fan of Wisconsin Public Broadcasting, and I know they want to hear real results and not just rhetoric, but I definitely don't want to move towards the direction of Donald Trump, and I said it first. Here in Milwaukee, you have a historic number of homicides taking place. I think it's the highest number in a decade, again. We just don't see solutions to this crime wave. And what I would do is, if I were in Congress, first of all, I think we're going to have a surge of law enforcement. And, you know, I'm very worried about mass incarceration. I was born in the 53206 zip code, the highest black male mass incarceration zip code in the nation. I'm a defense lawyer. I understand what is involved here in addition to my time in the legislature. But what we have here is we cannot stabilize this community unless we have control of this community. And just like extra resources were poured into Fallujah by the federal government in Iraq to try to calm things down, to restore democracy, we need that here. We need U.S. Marshals. We need more FBI agents. We need more collaboration, more technology between law enforcement agencies. We need the use of big data and technology. We know from the Milwaukee Homicide Commission where the homicides are taking place, when they're taking place. We need to use that information to get results to calm things down. As it relates to the carjackings and the other types of driving offenses, the Milwaukee police have been diverted from patrolling the roads because of the more serious crimes that are out there, but it's causing this contagion I spoke about. And I think we are seeing evidence that you can figure out from youth criminal justice information who it is we should track. And like Kansas City and Minneapolis, we should implement the type of services and attention to try to make sure we can stop them from committing more and more crimes once they've been identified. These are specifics on just this narrow area where I know I can bring results.
And obviously that's a top priority for you. Can you tell us about what some of your other top priorities would be besides addressing what you see as a crime wave in the area?
Well, again, I think that the listeners of Wisconsin Public Broadcasting understand you have to do more than just stand on the soapbox as a politician and talk about crime. I think jobs are important. What did I do as a state senator? First of all, I brought resources into this community. Working with John Norquist, we built the DNR building on 3rd Street, now King Drive and North Avenue. I worked to bring the women's prison here on 6th and Keefe, the men's prison, Felmer's Cheney, on Fond du Lac Avenue. Working with Governor Thompson across the aisle, we put the new dental school on the Marquette campus. We worked heavily together, both rural and urban legislators, to put this program in place at MMSD so that we can train people to take advantage of those jobs. And, you know, a lot of the work at MMSD is also financed by federal funds. Gwen has been completely silent on the privatization of MMSD, the fact that they are not committed in the same way as when I was in the Senate to hiring minority young men and women, to giving out contracts to minority young men and women. I mean, we have so much work to replace the piping from the houses to the streets, as well as the lead piping like they have in Flint. Those jobs can't be exported, but we did the worst thing. We exported the control over those jobs to a company that's really, I think, out of the country. And we're just missing opportunities like that to create the type of jobs that could help us work us through some of the social challenges that really have made Milwaukee the worst place to live if you're black in the country, where an educational system is such that you see massive failure across the Justice System. You know, it's the 40th year, I think, now of the desegregation decision here in Milwaukee. Desegregation is worse than ever, and I think it's proven since Brown versus Board of Education that if you don't have desegregation, the quality of performance and educational experience for minority students in particular is severely diminished. And you see a Republican legislature that has taken away the 220 program, they've defunded the SAGE program, which lowers class size, they failed to support a program that I personally thought was a fantastic elementary program, the P5 program, again, to lower class size and give support to younger elementary students and their teachers. I mean, we have just failed as a Democratic Party to offer not only the alternatives to the Republicans, but also to support the gains that we had made previously. And that's what I think I can bring back, someone with a track record of bringing results, and that's why I'd like to have the chance to serve in Congress if nominated on August 9th.
We're talking with former State Senator Gary George. He's running for Congress in the state's 4th District in the Milwaukee area, and he's challenging incumbent Gwen Moore in the Democratic primary. And, Gary, you've talked about your critique of Representative Moore, saying you feel she's doing too much talking, not getting enough done. What do you think you would add to the equation that would allow you to get more done as you see it, to be more effective in that position?
Well, first of all, it's a question of attendance. Gwen has one of the worst absentee records in the Congress, and you can't do the job if you don't show up. I mean, there are a lot of people who are cynical about public officials and what they do in Washington. I think Gwen has sort of fallen into the Wall Street crowd that I think has led to criticism of Hillary Clinton. I personally have supported and actually to this day support Bernie Sanders. I think he's a much better alternative because I think the damage that's been done by Wall Street to our economy and to our nation cannot just be covered over because of party unity. And I think Gwen's taken money from hedge funds. And really, if you look at her campaign report at FEC.gov, you see tens of thousands of dollars spent on Uber and Lyft and airplane rides to I don't know where. The 4th District does not, you can't take a plane from one side to the other side of the 4th Congressional District. It's all in Milwaukee County. I mean, you've really just, and then the money goes out to other candidates. I mean, this is the type of politics that leads to cynicism. And if Milwaukee's problems were not so severe, maybe you could overlook it. But in my 23 years in the Senate, I never missed a roll call vote. I was there. I rose through the ranks of committee assignments to be chairman of the Finance Committee. I was president pro tem under Fred Risser in the Senate. I know it's important to invest in the institution. And if I go to Congress, with my range of experience, both professional and personal, I know I can make a difference for the people, and that's why I'm running.
Representative Moore has said that seniority is a big asset in Washington, and if you were to be elected, you would show up as a freshman there. Do you see that as a disadvantage?
Well, let's look at what Gwen's done with her seniority. SDC had a food contract. I mean, not S. Yeah, SDC had a weatherization contract. It was lost to, I think, an entity from Sheboygan. I mean, those created not only good jobs in the field doing the weatherization, but it created executive jobs. There were many minorities, women, who worked there. It was lost. Where was that seniority then? You look across the board at all of the ways that the federal government spends money. I mean, Gwen's seniority has not delivered for us. But if you look at what I did, like I cited earlier, you know, I brought buildings into this community. I brought operations into this community. I mean, I was a very strong advocate of public transportation. And when you look at our basic governmental services, transportation, education, human services, for example, daycare centers. The Walker administration has been extremely hard on the Milwaukee-based daycare centers. And there's a lot of federal money that flows into the state government, which gives Gwen or who's ever in Congress the chance to be an advocate, to really use the bully pulpit to speak up to protect the constituents, to argue why the Republican approach is not the right one. And Gwen has just been missing in action.
We're talking to former state Senator Gary George. He's from the state's 4th district, the Milwaukee area there, running for Congress. And he's challenging incumbent Gwen Moore in the Democratic primary, and Election Day is Tuesday, August 9th.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you live in that area, what questions do you have for Gary George? What issues are most important for you? What should be the top priorities for Congress next year? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're talking to congressional candidate Gary George. He's challenging incumbent Gwen Moore in the Democratic primary for the Milwaukee area 4th congressional district.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your top issue for Congress? What questions do you have for the candidate? If you live in that district in the Milwaukee area, what are your priorities for Congress and the federal government? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And Gary, your political history has had some low moments, including a 2004 felony conviction on charges that you'd conspired to defraud the government. What would you say to voters who are concerned about that track record?
Well, first of all, I'd say that I'm innocent. If you look at the Supreme Court decision recently for Governor McDonnell in Virginia, as well as a previous one involving Mr. Skilling, and there was an Alaska state representative as part of that, it made clear what they, George Bush's U.S. attorney said about me just wasn't true. But the facts are the facts. I took responsibility for it under the circumstances, and I paid my price, and I think the people of the district and the people of Wisconsin are forgiving, and they want to give me a second chance. There are a lot of people who know that I worked extremely hard to be a good public servant when I was in office, and my plight, my fate is not much different than the people, a lot of people I represent. You know, there are a lot of people who are African American like me and male who find themselves in the same position. As Justice Sotomayor said recently, and I paraphrase, you know, it's like a civil death when you have that kind of a legal problem that I had. But that's not the problem for the people of the district. The people of the district want someone who's going to get the job done. And I think I can be an example of someone who continued to work on behalf of the community, who can contribute with their skills to do the best that they can. And I think compared to Gwen, I mean, I there are a lot of people who like Gwen. And Gwen is likable. She'll be okay no matter what. She's going to be fine. But I think if you look at the last 12 years of what she's done while she's in office, you can't really believe the next two are going to be any better. And I think as I travel around the district, I mean, there are parts of the district Gwen just doesn't even go to. I mean, Cudahy, South Milwaukee, St. Francis, up in the North Shore, I think you've got a lot of people who are worried about a range of issues. I'll give you one in particular. I think a lot of people are worried about the quality of Lake Michigan. They're worried about the environmental damage that it's suffering. I mean, Gwen has not been a strong advocate on that. I think the freshwater sciences building for UWM creates a real opportunity, working with the Water Council as well, to make us unique not only in the country but in the world in protecting fresh water. And I would like to be there working for them as a real partner to make a difference. And again, I have the track record to show it. I mean, in your program, I don't have time to obviously go over everything, but I think that's why I make the best candidate.
And we've talked a lot about the issues facing the Milwaukee area, but on a national scale now, what do you see as one or two of our nation's biggest challenges and how you might approach those?
Well, I think clearly the reason, in part, that I think people are so supportive of Bernie Sanders is the danger, as I mentioned before, of letting Wall Street control the economy. I think if you see what happened in 2008, you don't want to go back there. In addition, I think Bernie Sanders is right about our approach towards war. I don't think we ought to be doing what Secretary Clinton and the president did in Libya. I don't think overthrowing governments, I don't think assassinations that you label as, quote, taking people out, close quote, or quote, taking people off the battlefield, close quote, is an honest way to talk about the use of governmental power. And I think we're failing to use our other assets here, our economic assets, our other ability to build economies around the world to really make the United States position stronger. It's not going to get stronger by itself through military power. I believe we have to have a strong military. I think, you know, like Les Aspin, if I'm in Congress, I'd like to follow his example and make sure that the expenditures through the military budget and other governmental expenditures provide contracts and jobs for the people in this area. I mean, that's the kind of congressman I'd like to follow. One of the predecessors in Congress, Jerry Klutschko, I served with him in the legislature. I mean, he was a hawk in trying to find government efficiency. I mean, these things, and, you know, following an example of Henry Royce and Bill Proxmire, Henry Royce, of course, also being the 5th District, now the 4th District Congressman. I mean, these are the people that I would model my tenure after in Congress. There's no question the government wastes a lot of money. And I think the priority ought to be people, it ought to be education, it ought to be planning for the future. And I'd like to see new approaches, and that's what I would advocate for if I'm elected.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Joe on the line with us in Milwaukee. Joe, hi.
Hi there. I heard you commenting earlier about bringing in federal funds to increase police activity in the city of Milwaukee in order to fight crime. And I would put it to you that I don't know if you're aware of this or not, but in Milwaukee, almost one out of every two black men between the ages of 18 and 35 have been significantly involved in the criminal justice system, that is to say, incarcerated or convicted of something, which makes them virtually unemployable. I would put it to you that it's not under-policing that's affecting this community. It's massive over-policing directed at black people.
Joe, that's a good place to leave it. And Gary George, what's your response to that?
Well, I couldn't agree more. I think one of the problems is a lack of diversity in the police department. I think it's pretty clear that black police officers usually don't shoot black suspects or black men, and that leads to a lot of outrage. We've got the Dontre Hamilton situation here. We've got others that have been cited. There are ongoing protests across the state, Madison, Milwaukee, and other places. But the fact remains that there are, statistical ways to approach this, and I think the police department is doing it in part. I'd like to see more diversity in the police department, but I think we need more resources in here at the times when these crimes are being committed. My approach is not to lock people up. My approach is to show the presence and the hope that it prevents crime. I am a defense lawyer. I represent people. I know how it feels. I've seen situations where the police have taken advantage, haven't been truthful, and all the rest. I've seen judges and prosecutors who go too far. But at the same time, as a member of Congress, I know that there are constituents out there who park their cars in the front of their house because they're afraid of going to their garage at night in what used to be middle-class neighborhoods. I know women in the North Shore who are very afraid of carjackings when they go to the Bayshore Mall. And that's not to criticize the Bayshore Mall. I think Bayshore and Mayfair and the other malls are doing all they can to provide safety, a Midtown Mall in Milwaukee on Capitol Drive, but that fear is there, and it's made worse by what they see on the news. So I am not advocating for a targeting of black men. No, I am advocating that we have more diversity in the police department, that we coordinate our efforts, we bring in the extra help that we need. I mean, the police are still the best people to patrol the actual streets. And, you know, I've personally seen people drive around others at stoplights and blow through stop signs. Even last week, I saw somebody, a number of people do it when I was parked on 31st and Juneau. I mean, this is a very real problem in Milwaukee. And if you don't live here, you may not understand it. And so I feel a sense of urgency that I think the rest of the elected officials don't feel. They respond to the crises. But when it comes to finding solutions, solutions. We don't have them.
Gary George, thank you so much for joining us today. We were speaking there. Gary George, former Wisconsin State Senator and candidate in the Democratic primary in the 4th Congressional District. He's challenging incumbent Gwen Moore in the primary election on August 9th. And by the way, Representative Moore with us tomorrow here on Central Time. Today is a special and it's kind of a sad day here on Central Time. We're saying goodbye to our friend and Central Time producer, Matt Olson. Matt does a lot around here. And on Monday, by the way, he's always in the booth directing the show. We like to refer to this special day as Mustache Monday.
No more Mustache Mondays, though you did start up a new one for us on this last Mustache Monday. And Matt, along with the stuff you do here producing shows, keeping us in line, you've been key to the best smellers lists. You guys, and I've done this in the past too, we get books here. You guys smell every new book that gets sent to Central Time.
Yes, we do. We smell every book that comes into the office. Mm-hmm. Our regular listeners might remember my colleague Jay Carlisle Larson and I came on the show about a month ago to kind of talk about the start of that list and some of the books that are on there. And it's just one of the many things I'm going to miss about working here at WPR. Some of the silly stuff we do to blow off steam at the end of the day, but also working with such talented people and doing really important work.
Well, Matt, we appreciate you. We're going to miss you. And we have a very special thank you gift that we left in our office. But the gift is, can you guess it? It's number one with a bullet on the best smellers list. Name that book.
Number one on the best smellers list. That's First Dads. Could never forget that smell. Could never forget that book.
First
and
Dads.
I appreciate the gift.
And it's going to go home with
it's
you.
It's a classic right down the middle. You think of a book smell. This is the book to smell.
That's it. Yeah.
All right. Perfect. Hey, thanks for all the work, Matt. And
thank
all the
you.
Fun.
Thank
Who
you.
Who picked this really sad music?
That was me. I'm very sad.
We're going to miss you, Matt.
On Central Time.